I'm here with Thomas Frank, who is most recently the author of Pity the Billionaire. Tom, how are you doing in this apocalyptic year?
Oh, Ed, it's a great year for the apocalypse.
Fantastic. Well, it's funny that we're talking only a few nights after there was a really fascinating 60 Minutes interview with Eric Cantor. I'm not sure if you saw this.
I didn't see it.
Well, it was interesting because it reminded me very much of your book. I'm about to talk with you and this happened. So he appears and it's this kind of, you know, fairly amicable, typical segment. And then Leslie Stahl basically says, will you compromise in any way? And he dodged that issue of being able to compromise on anything. And then Leslie, of course, brings up the Reagan tax increase, which Cantor...
The 1986.
Sort of, yes. And he denies that Reagan ever did that. And then, to add an additional monkey wrench into this, there is an off-camera press secretary who says, that's a lie. And, of course, they play the clip.
What?
Yes. And they play a clip of, you know, Reagan using compromise as a verb when he's talking about this tax increase. So this seems a very appropriate beginning to some of the issues
that's
in your
amazing.
Book about
that's exactly what I'm writing about.
These
people who are essentially blinded by ideology. But when I say it that way, slang term or something like that. But I mean it. I mean it in a very serious way. That these are people who have bought an entire utopian way of seeing the world and are able to close their eyes to things that are obvious. And what you just said about Reagan, that would be a juicy detail that I would have loved to have had for the book. But there are so many other examples. Essentially, they deny that. I mean, I went to a graduate school and studied history. One of the sort of baseline things that historians agree on is that for the last 30 or 40 years we've been in a conservative era.
Yeah.
You know, that we've that people around the world, governments, politicians, elites around the world have discovered the power of markets and have moved in this direction towards markets, have deregulated, have privatized, have done all those things. This is common knowledge. Okay. A conservative movement today, you talk to a guy like Eric Cantor, no, that's never happened.
Yeah.
That's never happened. We're still living under socialism.
Yeah.
You know, we have been ever since Woodrow Wilson or something like this, you know.
But why is it that Cantor and the freshman Republicans want to just keep their blinders on about history, about their man, Reagan, and is there a specific...
They have to have a hero, and they've thrown George W. Bush under the bus, okay, because of the bailouts. Look, at the end of the day, it's opportunism.
Yeah.
Reagan is very popular. Bush is not popular. Nixon is not popular, you know? So they have to have a hero, and it has to be someone who is beloved. Ipso facto, it has to be Reagan. But they have to deny all sorts of things about Reagan. For example, Reagan bailed out Continental Illinois Bank. At the time, the biggest bank failure in U.S. history. You know, Reagan, as you just mentioned, raised taxes. Reagan sold weapons to Iran.
Yeah.
You remember that one?
Iran-Contra.
I mean, they're all kinds of other crazy things that Reagan did that don't look so good. You know, Reagan really liked Franklin Roosevelt.
Yeah.
Reagan was a more complicated person, but none of that is admissible. Okay? If you're going to follow this ideology and this sort of utopian vision that they have of what I call market populism, if you're going to follow that all the way, and of course, part of the idea of this is that you have to follow it all the way, and we'll get to that in a minute,
sure.
You basically have to whitewash history. I mean, it's almost Soviet, what you're describing.
There's a phrase you use in The Wrecking Crew: the Washington conservatives aim to make liberalism irrelevant not by debating, but by erasing it. And I'm wondering if there's any past political precedent that would suggest that they could entirely efface liberalism from our political machinations.
Or from our memory.
Our memory. I mean, it's very strange.
Well, that was the big subject a few years ago when The Wrecking Crew was published, one of the topics of conversation was these grand schemes that the Republicans kept coming up with, the Republicans in Washington here I'm talking about, I'm not talking about your rank-and-file Republicans, but the Republicans in Washington kept coming up with these grand schemes for some kind of political checkmate, some kind of move that would end the debate forever and yield victory for their side forever. And, you know, they include, like, privatizing Social Security was a big one. Another one, the one that I focused on in The Wrecking Crew, was deficits. And that, I'm sorry to say, I turned out to be right about that one. By deliberately running up the deficits in the Bush years, it doesn't... it doesn't give them permanent victory, but it does stay the hand of whoever, whatever liberal follows the, in this case, Barack Obama, and it has worked exactly as they planned it to.
Yeah.
Although Obama pushed it a little farther than they thought possible with the stimulus package, but now look what's happened with the debt ceiling catastrophe and all that sort of thing. So that turned out to be effective. They were able to limit the debate by some deeds that some things that they pulled while they were still in power. And some of the other things that they are trying or will try, or I predict they'll try, I mean, are things about restricting the franchise somehow, keeping or dissuading people from voting, making it, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But there's always this sort of this search for the doomsday device. And yes, and it still goes on.
But this level of no quarter, no compromise, I mean, isn't there some sort of uncanny valley or a Hubbard's Peak to what they can do before it's just not acceptable? I mean, there was that latest Rasmussen poll where Congress got a 5% approval rating. That was a few days ago.
5%.
5%. I mean, but I joked that the UE ball.
That makes a difference in the presidential election, but that really won't make a whole lot of difference in the congressional, strangely enough, in the congressional election,
yeah.
Because people might hate Congress, but they like their own congressmen. That's the sort of the classic, you know, the old saw. But look, what you're getting at is a really interesting phenomenon of these people, instead of being pulled to the center, as all of your political science theorizing and all of your DC punditry insists that the gravity of politics pulls people to the center. Okay, political scientists have believed this for 50 years. Now this is a pet peeve of mine, because I think it's rubbish. Okay, for reasons that we'll go into, but it's been just dramatically disproven in the last couple of years. Think back to 2008. You had the Republican Party in ruins. I mean, you had all these scandals in the Bush administration, all this corruption, and then it ends with this, you know, catastrophic meltdown in the markets. The housing bubble bursts, the banks start to go under one after another. Then Wall Street starts shedding 700 points per day. You know, it's this crazy disaster, the financial crisis, and then they do the bailouts, forever sealing Bush's fate, not only with the general public but with the right. You know, one of the most unpopular presidents of all time. The Republican Party is in ruins in 2008, and you have pundit after pundit weighing in and saying these people are done for. Bush led them too far to the right. This is the crime, you know, the error of George W. Bush was that they went too far to the right, and, you know, and Tom DeLay and all those guys, they went too far to the right, and now they have to make their way back to the center, or they will risk being irrelevant forevermore,
yeah.
Or for the next 20 years or something like that. And look what happened. They did the opposite.
Yes.
Guys like Eric Cantor, they did not embrace the moderates in their party. They excommunicated them.
Yeah.
They purged them. I mean, these guys, they behave like communists in a lot of ways. And this is one of the things, they purged these guys. They threw people out. And, you know, they don't want them in the party anymore. And they moved deliberately to the right, way to the right. That's what the Tea Party movement is all about. And I'll be damned if it didn't work. They just scored their biggest victory in 80 years. Or, well, 70, what, 70, a lot of years, okay? In the 2010, off year elections. They had a huge victory. And so obviously that strategy has vindicated for them. It worked. It paid off. And there's no reason why they would go back on something that just succeeded.
Yeah.
It was a success.
But in your chapter in this book, The Silence of the Technocrats, you describe this collapse of democratic populism from 2008. You point to the failings of the Democrats to challenge the Tea Party people at the town hall meetings. You point also to the manner in which they formed corporate alliances with healthcare and also
right.
the bailouts that we were just talking about,
yep.
The failure of the stimulus package, the list goes on. Only a few days ago, Obama signed into law the NDAA, which essentially gives the government the right to detain any citizen,
yeah.
And he had this whole without reservations clause that he did while he signed it. So the question I have is, you know, if Democrats are
yep.
offering the defense
right.
that Obama is being forced into this predicament.
They're listening to the pundits.
Yeah.
Well, the Republicans did the opposite of what the pundits suggested. The Democrats are listening to them, this sort of D.C., elite. the Democrats are listening. They want to try to this is what Obama's presidency is all about, was looking for a grand compromise with the Republicans, and they're not interested.
Yeah.
You know, make him come to us, they say. And, you know, he can come to us. He can compromise in our direction. But, yeah. You know, which is, look, at the end of the game, this is something you can figure out with game theory. It's really simple, you know. If the side that stands pat and makes the other guy come to them, they win.
Yeah.
You know, but that's neither here nor there. I think the Democrats really misplayed the hand they were dealt in 2008. I mean, misplayed it in a colossal manner, in a catastrophic manner. I mean, Obama may well get reelected in 2012. Who knows at this point, right?
With the crop of candidates, I mean, it's a big cloud.
Yeah, but reelected for what purpose? I mean, after what's happened, yeah. You know, why bother?
Yeah.
They didn't understand the needs of the moment, the cultural or political needs of the moment, which were populist. Okay, they didn't understand that all that political science theorizing that I was talking about, where the center is where the gravity always pulls you. You know, you have to move to the center, you have to make compromise with the other side. That all of that old way of thinking about everything was discredited. Okay, the financial crisis, the Great Recession, the huge business slump. We're going into Great Depression number two, it looked like back then, and what was called for was a 1930s style politics. The conservatives offered it, the Republicans offered it, or I should say the Tea Party movement offered it, and has since grafted it onto the Republican Party. And the Democrats behaved as though everything was just like it was in the 1990s. As if they acted like Bill Clinton, everything would be fine. They did not understand that old scheme was completely out the window.
Why, though, would they continue to act as if they wish to rise above partisanship?
That's who they are.
I mean, the whole debt ceiling showdown, that whole
business.
Can you
believe it? Wouldn't that be a convincer? Don't you think that would be like...
I mean, but why do you think this is? I mean, why didn't Obama just go to the people and say, look, this is going to have serious actions if I approve it or if I veto it? I am actually going to you, the American people, and I'm explaining to you that the Republicans want to basically throw the Bill of Rights into a flaming trash can. So, you know, I can't in good conscience sign this. Why do you think he can't do that?
The point where this really got me, I mean, there were several big turning points in the Obama presidency, but the one that really just blew my mind, because it was such a poor, it was such a misplayed moment. And we think of Obama as a very intelligent man, and he is. I mean, I've met him. He's super duper smart guy, but some of the political moves have just been, you know, total rookie mistakes. The one that got me was when he still had a Democratic Congress. It was a lame duck session. This would have been at the end of 2009. This would have been at the end of 2010, and he renewed the Bush tax cuts.
Yes.
You know, why not make the Republicans come to him and offer something in exchange for that? No, he just gave it to them.
Yeah.
It's like the biggest, you know, the biggest prize on the table, and he just handed it over.
Leaving Bernie Sanders to do that long filibuster.
Yeah.
I mean, but that ended up being all for naught, even though it was an impressive theatrical display, even though everybody was behind Bernie Sanders, finally someone standing up.
Oh, sure, but it wasn't up to Bernie Sanders. It was up to Barack Obama.
Yeah.
And he just gave it away. You know, the one, you know, the ace he had in the hole, and he just gave it away. And, you know, and so, you know, maybe he did it as a good faith, you know, good faith gesture to the Republicans.
Yeah.
And look what it got him. I mean, this terrible smackdown with the debt ceiling crisis, you know.
An embarrassment.
That kind of, but that's the kind of naivete that takes. I mean, to not understand that's how these guys play the game.
Yeah.
There's plenty of journalists that wrote about the DeLay Congress and the Gingrich Congress. We know how these guys play, you know, or how the George W. Bush. Look at the career of Karl Rove. These guys play to win.
Yeah.
They don't mess around, you know. And the sort of innocence about Washington that it took to make a blunder. Let's call it what it is. A blunder like that is shocking to me.
If he's so smart, why does he constantly come to them? I mean, why give the game away like that? Why
that's
not
who
have
they
this?
Are. That's the Democratic Party nowadays. They
it's been
they,
like that for a while, though.
It,
you know,
it has. And look, and hey, let's be fair. You know, Obama isn't the all of their last, like, say, six presidential candidates have been cut from the same cloth. Yeah. I think Obama is, in lots of ways, smarter and a better speaker and, you know, more talented than a lot of their previous, you know, leaders. But this is who the Democratic Party has become. When, you know, many years ago, they were a party of, you know, of the working man. That's yeah. Everyone knew that.
Yeah.
They were also a party that had an ideology that arose from organized labor, that arose from the New Deal, you know, and that has been lost. They are the party of technocrats now. And look, everything that I'm telling you right now is right out on the surface down in Washington, D.C. You know, the big Democratic Party thinkers talk about this all the time. We are the party of the professional class. And if we aren't that yet, that's who we're going to be when we're done. You know,
yeah.
We're going to get there eventually. And so they want to be the party that respects learning and that respects, you know, academia, respects expertise, okay? That turned out to be exactly the wrong thing for the moment of the financial crisis, when expertise was, I mean, oh my God, these are the people that screwed everything up. The experts, this is the expertise of the country lies in ruins on the floor. You know, to think that you'd see that as a moment to, you know, to build up a new reverence for experts. It's mind-blowing.
Yeah.
To misread the signals like that. But, well, you know.
Maybe another way to look at this is to, I suppose, look at it in degrees. I mean, you have a point in this book where you compare the TARP bailouts under Obama with the bailouts that went on under Roosevelt. You write that Jesse Jones, those Roosevelt bailouts, whereby the Reconstruction Finance Corporation was not an instrument of Wall Street. It may not have helped, but this would have made it impossible for the revived right to present themselves as opponents of Wall Street. So
that's an interesting point that you focus on.
It's interesting because what factors do you think make Obama resistant to this RFC?
Well, I'm sure he didn't know about it. I mean, nobody did.
Yeah.
Well, I did the research on that. That was, you know, I was finishing up writing the book, and the one of the themes that runs throughout is the issue of the bailouts, which were this abomination. It just shocked and horrified America. I mean, I remember my dad saying, you know, this is an obscenity. He couldn't believe this was happening. And, you know, lots of conservatives that I knew said the same thing. The Tea Party movement, you know, grabbed this with both hands. This was their great opportunity. And they said, okay, well, this is the time to call for a more purified capitalism.
Yeah.
Okay? Which I guess under if you're a absolutely pure free market system, then you wouldn't bail out banks. But there never has been absolutely pure. I mean, that's never happened in our history. Lots of conservatives have bailed out banks. And so I was doing some research on this subject, the history of bailouts. I got very intrigued about the history of bailouts. And I looked up the sort of granddaddy of all bailouts, which were in the early years of the Depression. And this was, I did this research on it, and then I went back and looked about what the country was talking about in 2008 when the bailouts were in our time were actually going on. The Hoover administration, Roosevelt administration bailouts were almost never mentioned. There may be two or three pundits brought it up, period. That was it. In all the millions of words written about the bank bailouts and the TARP and all that stuff and Goldman Sachs and everything like that, nobody knew about this. It just wasn't written about. So I went back and did the research. And lo and behold, Herbert Hoover started doing the bailouts, much like George W. Bush did. And they were exactly the same as they were in our own time. Pure cronyism. They were guys bailing out their friends, just like, you know, Hank Paulson bailing out his buddies on Wall Street. And then Roosevelt came. Roosevelt was highly critical of the bailouts. We forget now, but in 1932, this was one of his great issues, that we were bailing out Wall Street and Wall Street's various puppets while we were letting, I mean, there's a famous example. They bailed out a big bank in Chicago while the teachers of Chicago hadn't been paid for 2 years or something like this, the public school teachers. And this was, people were outraged by that. And this was one of Roosevelt's calling card issues in 1932. He wins the presidency. What does he do? Does he continue the bailout policy? Hell no.
Yeah.
I mean, he continues bailouts because you had to.
Yeah.
But he did it completely differently. So They bailed out they basically said, we're not, you know, the putting the economy back on a status quo ante is not going to happen. We're not putting Wall Street back in charge of the economy. We're going to bail it out from the bottom up.
Yeah.
They're going to bail out every little, you know, mom and dad financial entity, you know, like down to cattle auction centers out in the Great Plains. You know, funny little things. Every little credit union, every little SNL, that's who they were going to bail out. And they were very invasive with their bailouts of the big banks. They would go in and fire the staff, you know, or fire the management, something that our Obama and company have never done. Well, they did it with GM.
Okay? Yeah.
They never did it with. They never dared to do it with Wall Street or any of the banks. They really took charge of things, and it had a very, their bailouts had a very populist flavor to them. And that has not, it's one of many things that just completely off the table, as though it never happened. It wasn't even imagined by our current crop of Democrats running things when they got in. No, they just continued the Bush policy.
Yeah.
You know, it's exactly the same, what they did in 2009, exactly the same as what Hank Paulson started them doing.
Do you think that the inability of administrations over the last 50 years to tweak a policy such as a bailout to suit the needs of the party or the expectations of the people is one of the reasons why the conservatives have managed to take some of the ideology from the other side, mimic it, and adopt it as their own? I mean, what of
this?
Oh,
yeah. Well, if they're, yeah. I mean, the Tea Party movement succeeded by speaking in these tones of pure outrage.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, that's 90% of the battle right there. Now, what I did in the book is, look, you scratch the surface of what the Tea Party is calling for, and they're calling for exactly the wrong things. They're calling for, you know, let's deregulate more. Yeah, great idea, guys.
Yeah.
You know, let's go back on the gold standard. This is, you know, idiotic. This is, you'd be in the same pickle that the Greeks are in right now, you know. It's I mean, everything they suggested, every remedy they suggested is positively stupid. But, okay, with a few exceptions. But they had the outrage. They sound like a hard times protest movement. And I can't emphasize enough how important that was in that climate in 2009 and 2010. They sounded exactly like a hard times protest movement. And there's two whole chapters of the book about how they mimicked protest movements of the 1930s, sometimes very deliberately, as in the case of Glenn Beck, who, I mean, the man is like...
Who also was a big fan of Orson Welles.
Orson Welles, yes, and not just any Orson Welles.
Yeah.
Not the obscure stuff either. The Martians are coming.
Yeah. War of the Worlds.
That's what Glenn Beck is all about. When I figured that out, that's when the nickel dropped for me.
Yeah.
Or one of the many points where the light went on.
You production know,
the
company named Mercury. The there you go.
Because that was the show that scared everybody.
Yeah.
Remember?
Yeah.
And that's what Glenn Beck does. He frightens everybody all the time. The Martians are coming. The Martians are coming.
Yeah. But, I mean, Glenn Beck is no longer part of the equation. I mean, he's no longer on Fox News, so...
He's still a big presence on talk radio.
Yeah.
And I get emails from him every day. I'm on his list.
Oh, really?
His email, whatever list.
Just sort of checking him out to see what he's going
to
say next.
I signed up for it back when I was doing the research for the book, you know, when he was still on Fox News. Well, I didn't, you know, I don't see any reason to it.
Yeah,
it keeps me in touch with a certain part of America, you know?
I wanted to talk about the idea of reaction as revolution politics. This was something you described in The Wrecking Crew. It occurred under the Reagan years. In that book, you described how the college Republicans, under the forces of Jack Abramoff, Grover Norquist, Tom DeLay, some of these things are still going on right now, they treasured confrontation with the left over all else.
Grover is back, you know.
Grover is back, yes, in a very big way. We could talk about that.
Yeah.
The right, they didn't want civility or fair play. They wanted quasi-military radical victory. The left, or what supposedly counts for them, has had more than three decades of variations on this. So, you know, what ultimately accounts for why the left constantly is the right's
punching
bag?
Why are they constantly surprised
by this? Exactly. You would think, especially with Obama constantly getting played like this, that he would not adopt these tactics of giving in. I mean,
I think he's, on the one hand, he's probably very poorly advised. On the other, I don't know how you can ignore a body of literature as, you know, there's an enormous body of literature about the conservative movement now. It's not like when I wrote What's the Matter with Kansas, there was very little, okay?
Yeah.
But now there's all kinds of stuff out about this, and to pretend that you don't know about this, that they're confrontational, that they imagine you as communists, you know, they're, everything is like the Cold War, you know? That's how they think. I try to, you know, get some of that flavor into this new book, Pity the Billionaire. And there's one point where I was thinking about, you know, there was a slogan that the conservative movement had in the 1970s, organized discontent.
Yes.
I believe it was Howard Phillips came up with this line, organized discontent. That's what we do. And that's like, frankly, that's what the IWW used to do.
Yes.
I mean, they're imagining themselves following in the footsteps of these American radicals from long ago, organizing discontent. And that's what the Tea Party movement was doing. And there's something really powerful about that. But the Democrats are allergic to that. They are they regard discontent as dysfunction. I mean, the Democratic style, look, going back to like Michael Dukakis, but John Kerry, yeah. Al Gore, all of these guys, their style is cold, analytical, professional.
Yeah.
You know, and even
civility.
Civility is very important to them. But the idea of organizing discontent, they don't even understand that.
Yeah.
I mean, they know what policies have to be put in place.
Yeah.
They know you need to do deficit spending in a situation like this. Look, I'm pretty liberal. I'm even a registered Democrat. Okay, and I agree with what they, you know, things like deficit spending, the big stimulus package. That was the right thing to do. The thing is, they know that's the right thing to do because that's what the Roosevelt administration did. Well, Roosevelt didn't just do it.
Yeah.
He campaigned for it. He explained it. He fought for
yes.
it. He told us why. You know, there were huge movements abroad in the land to
yes.
tell us why we
yes.
had to have Social Security. And
which is one of the infuriating things about why I was so angry about the NDAA. Why didn't Obama do that same sort of stumping? You
yeah.
know?
But today. And I've got, you know, these really juicy quotes in the book where they're talking about this. It's like, well, we know we should do this because that's what the experts tell us we should do.
Yeah, yeah.
We should do it because the experts say we should do it. You're talking about, you know, an enormous change in the way our political lives are led, and you're just going to say because the experts tell us we have to do that?
Yes.
And that really is, that's how they tried to sell it.
Yeah.
And, you know, of course that failed. But, you know, okay, I'm stopping there, Ed. I just talked too damn much. I'm sorry.
No worries.
I drank all this coffee.
No, this is great. No, this is fantastic. Maybe another way to look at this, I was very glad to see that you pointed to John Stewart's Rally to Restore Sanity, this effort to do this mass civil protest
right.
to what
that
was going
the response
on.
To the Tea
that
Party.
Is the response. And, of course, that became forgotten. I mean, you know, the Stephen Colbert thing was more of a satirical take on this, as
yeah.
opposed to this, you know, let's go ahead.
But
and
Stewart
it was, quite
was
frankly,
the star. John
yeah.
Stewart was the star.
Yeah,
he gave the big speech.
But it's interesting because that completely floundered, and then we have the Occupy Wall Street movement, which is very pointed and
right.
very much in this discontent. I mean, why do they keep coming back to this idea of civility? Is there any kind of currency to the idea of
well,
civility?
I have to keep saying because that's who they are.
Yeah.
Democrats imagine themselves as the party of the professional class.
Yeah.
And the professional class, that's what they're about. They're
yeah.
about expertise, civility. You know, and I respect professionalism. I'm very interested in the subject of professionalism, and you know, it's an important thing. But that's not how you respond to, you know, you look at the environment that the country was in at the end of 2010. We're in this deep, deep business slump.
Yeah.
You know, you've just come through this period of unbelievable fraud on Wall Street and in the housing market.
Yeah.
And you've got a government that just where cronies bailed out cronies. And this what appears to be like the greatest theft from the Treasury of all times. You know, these things are it is a moment ripe for discontent. And you get out there and talk about restoring sanity?
Yeah.
That doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
And look, I liked John Stewart's speech. I thought it was really good. And in fact, in some ways, he has the right. He's one of my heroes.
Yeah.
I mean, I'll be straightforward with you. I think he's in a lot of cases, he's got exactly the right tone. He knows what's going on. But that whole thing was framed as this, you know, I'm with reasonable.
Yeah.
They sold these T-shirts that said, I'm
yeah.
with reasonable.
Yeah.
It was a rally to restore sanity. They called it the Million Moderate March.
Yeah.
No, 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 no. You have to, you know.
You had to be with a job, with a middle-class lifestyle to have the money to
make the trek down to D.C.
I mean, I didn't see working-class rabble. I mean, in fact, we don't want to have anything that
agitates. Well, it was people who, people who live in D.C., and
yeah.
I don't know if you're aware of this, is one of my other pet peeves I wrote about in The Wrecking Crew. It's the richest city in America now.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because it's such a professional place. There is no blue-collar, there's no manufacturing in Washington.
Yes.
It's a one-industry town, and there's no manufacturing. That's why there's no, like, solid
yeah.
blue-collar tradition there. You
yes.
can go up to Baltimore and find that.
Yes.
But not in D.C.
Yes.
You know, there's a lot of people with advanced degrees. I lived in a neighborhood where 50% of the people had PhDs.
Yeah.
50%, you know. That's like, you don't see that sort of thing outside of Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Yeah.
Or, you know, in Hyde Park in Chicago, you know. But
who watches NASCAR there? Yeah, that's my one.
NASCAR. They don't have a NASCAR Speedway in D.C., you know. The Beltway, right? It's
yeah.
all these BMWs, you know, going around all day, all night. That's their NASCAR track
yeah,
there.
Yeah,
but
obviously not entirely.
I'm not a big NASCAR
movement.
Fan, actually. But that's
every now and then. Wrestling.
It's so loud, you know. It's so loud.
But it's great after when you have a hangover. I watch those cars go around, and you know, anyway.
Yeah, but anyhow, so that was it struck the wrong note. It wasn't a destructive thing to do, but it illustrated for me the way that really well-meaning liberals just could not grasp what was going on around them. This I mean, I'm from Kansas City, as you know. You know, you go to a place like that, and there was panic in the air.
Yeah.
Okay? It's not a time to say, you know, let's all be reasonable with one another. It's a time to speak to that fear, that
righteous
anxiety.
Indignation was banned.
Yeah. But you look at a guy like Glenn Beck. Yeah. He was born for that moment, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
The Martians are coming. You know, that was his moment. He was made for it.
If the Tea Party served as a repository for the only place where people can go for righteous indignation, can you entirely blame some of them for going to this protest against what was happening in Washington?
No,
especially?
I went to the first one. I knew what to expect because it was called for by, you know, various conservatives, but I wanted to see it. You know, this was I don't blame them, and I also don't. I mean, we're talking about millions and millions and millions of people. We're talking about people who were deceived.
Yeah.
I mean, and that's really what this was. This is, I call it, the hard time swindle.
Yeah.
You know, you appeal to people by speaking to their emotions in a really, really compelling way, and then you sell them a bill of goods. You elect a guy like Scott Walker in Wisconsin who turns around and, you know, sticks the bayonet into organized labor. You know, it's like, what kind of move was that?
Yeah. Although it did make things quite interesting over there.
It sure did, but now he's got a populist movement on his hands going the other direction.
Yes, yes.
You know, where they turned on a dime in that state. And but by the way, that state went way to the right in 2010. They got rid of several, you know, well-known liberals, Russ Feingold, and went way to the right because, you know, all these populist conservatives. No, I don't blame people for voting.
Why can't things stick, like in this case or other places? Why can't liberalism stick? I mean, there's one really great passage in The Wrecking Crew where you say that people really like a liberal state.
Yeah.
I mean, you know,
well, this
if
is
that's
well-known.
The case,
people expect their social security.
Yeah. They want to have a secure retirement,
they expect Medicare. I thank God for Medicare. I mean, I have two parents who are in retirement, you know? And, you know, how do you think their savings went over the years? Yeah. You've had two bad stock market crashes in the last decade, you know? Thank God for Social Security. Thank God for Medicare.
Yeah.
You know, and thank God for the, you know, somebody makes sure that our water is drinkable. And, of course, people love the liberal state. And they expect the liberal state. And I'll go further than that. It never occurs to them that someone might do away with these things.
Yeah.
That just, in most people's worldview, that is not within the realm of the possible, and that's why it's so easy for, you know, for them to blow off, you know, when they talk about privatizing Social Security. You and I might know what that means. You know, if you dig below what's his name, Paul Ryan's statistics, or what he wants to do with Medicare, you can see what he's going to do, and it's not going to be pretty.
Yeah,
you know. But that requires a lot of digging and a lot of really, you know, and people don't they just can't believe that the system will serve them that poorly.
Yeah. Let's talk about another myth that you bring up in Pity the Billionaire, the myth of small business job creation. You have an endnote whereby Professor Scott Shane, writing for the New York Times website, points out the largest businesses, those over 500 employees, created 36% of the jobs between 1992 and 2006, followed by medium businesses creating 30%. So why then does Obama, the Tea Party, nearly every political force in the Capitol, they continue to champion the small business and the entrepreneur as the primary political
point? Yeah, they say things
point.
Like, oh, they say small businesses create 80%. Small businesses create 90%.
Exactly. They're the Glenn Beck
stuff. Because it doesn't mean anything. Small businesses is one thing is small business is an entirely emotional category.
Yeah.
There's the definitions for it go all over the map. The economists have one definition. The government has another.
Yeah.
You know,
like independent filmmaking when George Lucas called himself an independent filmmaker during the Phantom Menace. Yeah, same thing. Yeah.
Exactly. It's a sentimental thing. We think of small business in a very sentimental way, like, you know, I think of the people that are the adults that I grew up around, you know, and we love small businessmen because it's small businesses because it's people that we know, it's familiar to us, and so both parties, rather than talking about Exxon or Enron or Goldman or something like that, or Merrill or BP or Bank of America, they want to talk about capitalism. They want to talk about small business because that's who you love.
Yeah.
You know, nobody loves you know, a Wall Street bank.
Yeah.
I mean, somebody does. I don't know.
So, it's an effective smokescreen, basically.
Yeah. It's a smokescreen, but it's been used in a... Small business has a history of being used in a very particular way that is no different from propaganda.
Yeah.
And as I sort of delved into the history of how small business is used in American politics, I came across the landmark study on this. I didn't even know about this book. C. Wright Mills' book White Collar, which came out in 1951, and he had done this enormous study of small business in America, and he just declared at the end of this study, basically, small business serves as a propaganda front for big business. This is it's always cast in terms of small business. Small business is the face of capitalism, but the agenda that's always served is always big business.
Yeah.
And small business is deployed by big business. Small business is, he calls them like the storm troops.
Yeah.
That they send them into action against regulation and against organized labor and stuff like this. And this is what's happened with the Tea Party movement.
Yeah.
This is a very fascinating thing when I figured this out, that the Tea Party movement is essentially a small business movement. That's the leadership of it.
Yeah.
You know, over time it has a rank and file, all sorts of people voted for it, but its leadership is across the board is small business.
So it's basically selling a myth kind of akin to reality TV. You can be a star, you can have your own business, that really it's playing into the hands of the American public. I mean, why is this such an alluring prospect? Is it because we just don't want to discuss the fact that essentially we are all slaves to corporations in some sense?
Oh, man. I mean, harsh. Well, I mean, they also, and you're leaving out a factor here, the movement itself actually acts as a business. I mean, the participants in the... I don't know if you've ever gone to any of the big Tea Party rallies or conventions, but they hold these conventions, and the conventions always have a trade show attached to them.
Memorabilia show,
all that. Yes, where they're selling memorabilia to one another. And they, these are great fun. You know, that's where I do most of my conversations with people, and I always buy a lot of trinkets and stuff like this. And but you look at their heroes, like Glenn Beck. Glenn Beck speaks of himself as a small businessman.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's got his staff of whatever, 50 people or whatever it is, and he's an entrepreneur. He's even made a painting called Capitalism that I bought from his website. But that's their ideal of capitalism, is small business. One of the best anecdotes in Pity the Billionaire, this is the miracle of YouTube, by the way. Every candidate, every politician's, every utterance is filmed nowadays, and somebody puts it up on YouTube, and so you can see it. There's this a representative from upstate New York, I forget her name, but she's Tea Party type, Tea Party Republican, and she's speaking to a group of retirees. And retirees, generally speaking, have a more acute sense. I mean, they remember the New Deal, a lot of them. They often have an acute sense of, they're worried about their Social Security. They're worried about, a lot of them still care about organized labor because they're old enough to remember that, or they're retirees from a union. They have a pension or something like that. And so she's talking to a room full of retirees, and they are hopping mad about Verizon. Okay, there was a strike going on at the time, and they're really mad about Verizon outsourcing and getting rid of these jobs and offshoring jobs and this kind of thing. And they're asking the congresswoman, well, what about this? What about Verizon? One of the biggest companies in America. And her response is to start this sort of long, winding disquisition about how businesses are started. Like, well, you borrow some money from the bank and you start a small business, and they're like, but that has nothing to do. We're talking about Verizon, one of the biggest corporations in America. But for her, this sort of storybook tale of small business is all you need to know about capitalism. All you need to know is the utopian version.
Yeah.
And utopian is an important word in this context, okay? But all you need to know is the storybook version of capitalism. You don't need to know about Verizon or what their fight with their workforce, or what they're off, if they're offshoring, or if they're outsourcing, or if they're doing stock buybacks, or if they're doing any of these things. You don't need to know about that. You just need to know about how small businesses work. You need like the civics book that they give you in high school where you learn about how to start a business.
On the other hand, isn't there something to be said for getting people started. I mean, isn't small business something that can actually be a saving grace for
of
some
course,
people? I mean,
oh my God,
you know, isn't
yeah.
there a way to kind of,
hey,
okay,
look,
that's
I,
not...
I'm technically no, a small businessman myself.
Well, of course.
I file a Schedule C.
Of course. But I mean, like, you know, look at the Black Panther Party. It was all about, we're going to have our own money and we're going to have our own resources to stand up against the oppressive corporations.
Oh, sure.
Maybe this
oh,
is something comparable
way.
To that. Maybe small business does have some... applicability,
but
if we actually take the term back and actually talk about it honestly.
Sure, but what you're describing, there's all sorts of other avenues of organizing that are just as valid, whether it's co-ops or whether it's organized labor. You know, there's all sorts of other steps in there too. We tend to privilege small business because we have this, you know, the sentimental, emotional attachment to it. And look, I'm just as attached to it as anybody else. But it often serves to mask, you know, really dreadful things going on in the economy. As in this case I was talking about, like, actually a way of not talking about Verizon.
I'm wondering if there are specific terms that are still okay. Maybe we're getting into Lakoff-like territory.
Yeah.
But, I mean, is there any real base to build a legitimate opposition to a corrupt two-party system? I mean, what are your thoughts on this? That's a very general question, but I am.
Well, you have to build that kind of base. That's going to take a long time. The, you know, I honestly don't look. I come from Kansas, and the political movement that I always look back to with a lot of reverence is the populism days. Okay, in the 1890s, where they, you know, a bunch of people, they organized discontent. Literally sent organizers out into these counties. These farmers were suffering. Their, you know, prices were down. They were getting screwed by the railroads. This kind of thing. And they organized these farmers and they took over the state. And they did this all over the Midwest. Organized a third party and swept the other two parties out. Now they did it. Once populism died down, populism had used a bunch of electoral techniques to win their victories. And once populism died down, the two main parties made those techniques against the law. Okay, not for any good, you know, constitutional reason or any reason of principle, just because they didn't want that to happen again.
Yeah.
And so it's effectively impossible to have a third party movement nowadays in America because all those laws are still on the books. Now that's a really depressing thought. But what would be awesome, and I don't see any way to do this, but what would be awesome is if you could overturn those laws. And I mean, in the 19th century, they weren't the only third party movement. There were many of them. Populism was the only one that was effective. Actually, I take that back. The Republican Party was a third party at one time, and it grew up and challenged, you know, eventually knocked the other ones out. But populism was the last. And today it's basically illegal. And that's a really depressing thing. I think you have to organize outside of the parties, but I don't know. That's not where I went in my research with this book. But I'm a great believer in organized labor. And I like what I saw with the Occupy Wall Street people.
Yeah.
They need more organization. You know, they've got such a fetish for being disorganized.
Yeah.
I think that's probably a strategic mistake.
Well, there's one thing you write in Pity the Billionaire. Now people protested not only to advertise their views on a given issue, but, emphasis yours, out of resentment at the insults heaped upon protesters.
Yes. This is something you come across all the time.
And you then write, self-pity has become central in the consciousness of the resurgent right. Depicting themselves as victimized in any and every situation is not merely a fun game of upside down. It is essential to their self-understanding. I'm wondering if this
pity
idea...
Pity the billionaire, Ed.
Uh-huh.
Pity the billionaire.
Well, pity the billionaire. But
cry
on the other
for
hand, I think that some of these people who attend the Tea Party movements, perhaps they are attending out of a shared sense of humiliation, a shared sense of, well, we don't have anything, we have to latch on to something. I mean, is the Tea Party in any sense perhaps a gateway drug into something else, perhaps, that might be a little bit more legitimate? Or
More legitimate.
More
I was
legitimate,
thought you were going to say a gateway drug into like the Birch Society or something like that.
A conduit, probably that's a better way of saying it.
Yeah. They did put they put the language on the table, and they gave the Democrats, a real cold shower.
Yeah.
Okay. A real wake up call, to mix metaphors. Whether the Democrats got that or not is I don't think they did. They seem to be completely oblivious so far. I mean, they're making better noises now than they were a year ago. You know, Obama at his speech at Osawatomie was one of the best things he's done in a long time. But you know, they, I don't know what to say, because on the one hand, you know, what you say is completely true. They were speaking a language that had to be spoken. They were saying things that had to be said.
Yeah.
Okay. On the other hand, they were doing it in the service of such a you know, retrograde politics, such a nasty, vicious form of politics, that it's really hard for me to say that there was anything good about it.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah. Nothing good.
Okay.
I mean, in some sense.
They're right about the bailouts. Yeah. They vented that anger. And yeah. But you know what you're really seeing here is a case of populism being captured, populism being swiped.
Yeah.
Being stolen, rather than populism being expressed.
Yeah. So you're saying that all populist movements have to have an inherent liberalism behind them in order to actually affect reform for both parties?
Well, it's not populist if your solutions are just going to make Wall Street more powerful. You know, that's not, by definition, it's not. You see?
Yes. So I see what you're saying. I mean, you also get into how Atlas Shrugged has resonated among conservatives because it purports to have all the answers.
I read that book. I'll have you know.
I actually read it many years ago.
Oh, really?
Oh my God.
You read it on a dare?
I as an experiment.
Now, did you ever interview Ayn Rand?
No.
In this very lobby.
But you say that it has all the answers for a world facing Great Depression, too. You write the book Straightforward Sympathy for the Billionaire, plus Tangled Rationalizations for the Death or Humiliation, again, humiliation, of everyone else. Maybe the stuff that rings truest. Why do you think that this selfishness, this belief that, you know, corporations can do no harm or they are above regulation, which actually is not unlike, now that you think about it, the Steve Jobs worship and the Walter Isaacson. He was very brutal to his employees. He didn't give them stock shares when Apple was...
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
I never read that.
Yeah, I mean, and this was another huge bestseller. I think there's a strain here. Why do you think that this is such a draw, this idea of, I guess, pure selfishness? I mean, does it tie into the entrepreneurial...
The whole idea of we keep coming back to these words, pure utopian idealism and capitalism. And the reason that has been such a constant theme in the last two or three years is because there was nowhere else to go for the Republican Party, especially. You know, their leader had just handed out bailouts. George W. Bush had just handed out these bailouts to Wall Street. Hank Paulson had gone along with it. That whole White House, you know, the whole Republican leadership had committed this incredibly offensive deed, and they had to have a way to put daylight between them and that deed.
Yeah.
There's only one way for these guys, and that is to retreat into laissez-faire purity, idealism. Okay, and that means insisting that markets could solve every problem if you left them completely alone. It means traveling down that road in a really resolute and really disturbing way. And that's one of the chapters of the book that I'm proudest of, is the way these people embrace this idealism in the same manner that you saw on the left in the 1930s. It's almost identical. Ayn Rand, though, come back to Atlas Shrugged. As I was reading this book, I was astonished to find that it was essentially a book about the 1930s.
Yeah.
It's a book about hard times with all kinds of really obvious markers thrown in to indicate that it's about the Great Depression, but it's the Great Depression as conservatives imagine it.
Yeah.
Okay, so it's not the Great Depression that we know from history books, you know, what actually happened in 1929 to 1933. It's the Great Depression as it should have happened according to conservative theory. You know, government intervenes in the economy, and that's what causes the depression, okay? So this is, by the way, which is always the theory of your sort of Ron Paul types and a lot of the guys who are contesting who are trying to get the Republican nomination right now. You don't have business downturns unless government always causes them. And so that's what Atlas Shrugged is all about. Government is getting all involved in the economy. Government is, you know, is passing these insane regulations that are just driving people crazy, completely stamping out entrepreneurship and any kind of creativity, and of course bringing the economy to its knees, driving it to a state of collapse, and bringing on what's called a capital strike. And it wasn't until I actually finished the book that I discovered where she got the idea for the capital strike. This was something the Roosevelt people were very worried about in 1937, and they gave, I mean, I don't know for sure this is where Ayn Rand got the idea, but it seems likely that because the Roosevelt's senior advisors gave a series of speeches about blaming the recession of 1937 on what they called a capital strike, that the 1% of their time was basically withholding their investment in order to discredit Roosevelt, in order to make Roosevelt look bad. And the funny thing is, here's Ayn Rand imagining, it's like, hey, that's a good idea for a novel.
Yes. Yes. You know? But why is selfishness such an appealing virtue, more so than empathy, more so than humanism? Why isn't there some, I suppose, leftist version of Atlas Shrugged, which basically says, hey,
there is
togetherness.
There's all those books about the 1930s. You ever read John Dos Passos?
That's true. Oh, yeah, of course. Well, a lot of people don't these days, though.
Nobody does anymore. Yeah, but when I was in graduate school, he was my favorite.
Or Steinbeck, I suppose.
And Ayn Rand thought of herself as a right-wing Steinbeck.
Yeah.
That was one of her things.
Yeah, yeah.
But there were tons of writers in those days working that vein. They weren't as successful as her.
Yeah.
I mean, this is her novel, by the way, is, in my view, is one of my hobbies over the years. Is I collect examples of a totally forgotten genre of literature called proletarian fiction.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Nobody writes this anymore. Nobody reads this anymore.
But up in Sinclair's career, basically.
Yeah. Well, you know. And so, but I buy this stuff, you know, on eBay or secondhand bookshops, and I have a big collection of it. It's kind of fun. It's really bad. It's really awful stuff. It's very ideological. You know, it's always some playing out of some Marxist theory or other, you know. Yeah. The heroes are these very flat characters. There's no character development. You know, it's like, but
it needs more cold sex along the line of Ayn Rand or something, right?
They had that. Ayn Rand is my argument in Pity the Billionaire. Ayn Rand is this genre.
Yeah.
She is the last survival of this genre. In fact, she's the most successful example of this genre. There are places where she rises above this genre, but most of the time, I mean, her characters are completely wooden.
Yeah.
The plot is so stupid. The
dialogue goes on and on. Yeah,
yes,
yeah,
the
yeah.
characters never develop.
Yeah.
And all they want
there
to
are
do,
no families
just,
generally.
There's no families, no children.
Yeah.
Everybody's just longing to have a 20-page speech about selfishness and how awesome it is.
Yeah.
You know, and but she does rise above, in my opinion, in certain passages. You want to know what those are?
Yeah, feel free.
When she's describing machines. She's really good.
Yes.
This is her forte.
Steel and trains.
Yeah, trains. She's describing this train going down these tracks.
Yeah.
It's actually really beautiful. And I was, but by the way, very 1930s thing to describe like, really powerful streamliner chugging down the tracks to Denver or something like that. That's a total Art Deco kind of theme, a 1930s kind of theme. And here's Ayn Rand writing about it in the 50s. And here's our people today reading it and lapping it up and saying, oh my God, this is so awesome and so correct.
Yeah.
Her line is so correct and so fine.
I'm getting some really terrible ideas here. Well, first of all, I mean, it seems to me we've established that the rise of present conservatism has a lot to do with myth-making, whether it be through books like Ayn Rand or whether it be through denying the fact that Reagan actually did a tax increase.
I'm sorry to interrupt you for a second. There was a genre of literature that was very important to me while I was writing this. Yeah. I didn't manage to quote any of it because it's all written by these German sociologists from 80 years ago in the 1930s, and their prose is so dreadful that I couldn't bring myself to quote it. But it's about they're studying what was called the social construction of reality.
Yes.
Okay? And there's the classic book on the subject is called Ideology and Utopia by Karl Mannheim. Okay?
Yeah.
Great sociologist. And I'm reading this, and there's just like, and it's about the 1930s, on the one side, fascists, on the other side, communists, but both sides totally deceiving themselves about the world that they live in, which was a novel thing at the time and a shocking thing at the time. And as I'm reading this, there's just a million light bulbs going off in my head. It's like, oh my God, that's what's happening to us again. Here it is again. And this was the 30s. This was the 30s. The American leftists in particular are very famous for deceiving themselves about the Soviet Union, willfully blinding themselves to the reality of the Soviet Union. I mean, believing, propaganda that anyone should have been able to see through. And what you find today is the American right doing the same thing. They've discovered the sort of consolations of dogmatism,
How then does the American left fight this and win converts to their side?
I think with I think with pragmatism and with a little bit of passion and with a little bit of anger and with telling it like it is.
Yeah.
You know, the left in this country, with that exception in the 1930s, and by the way, and I'm talking about a marginal, frankly,
sure.
I'm talking about the Communist Party.
Sure,
I'm
sure,
talking
sure,
about
sure.
You know, a small group of people, but a group of people that they wrote a lot of books. Okay, so
yeah,
we know a lot about them.
Yeah.
But the mainstream American left, you know, its ideology is one of pragmatism. It's of a mixed regime, okay? It's a capitalist country, but a capitalist country that's regulated, you know, a capitalist country where there's all these checks and balances on the boardroom as well as on the, you know, on Congress. It's a, you know, it's a capitalist country where workers have a say. You know, they have a union, they get to vote, they get to have a voice in the workplace, which is disappearing before our eyes. And it's a place where all sorts of things are supposed to be beyond political question. You're going to have a secure retirement.
Yeah.
You're going to be able to afford health care. You know, and that's
these are myths right now.
Right, that's right. But
yeah.
this is the ideology that I like, right, that
yeah.
I'm behind. But it's not the same kind of it's not ideology and utopia in the Carl Mannheim sense. It's not this interlocking system where everything is explained, and if something doesn't fit, then you pretend it didn't happen, which
yeah.
is, you know, the Ayn Rand way of looking at the
sure.
world.
I guess
the Tea
I,
Party way of looking at the world.
What I'm suggesting is there could very well run the risk of, if we get behind a heavily neutered or a neutered Democratic Party,
yeah.
and we believe in
well, I'm
some,
not interested in that.
Yeah, yeah,
hey,
I
look,
know.
I'm not,
I know you won't, you and I are probably
I,
not,
know,
but
I'm a writer.
Saying,
what if to hell with parties.
Yeah, yeah, I know, but what if people have to get behind this out of necessity because that's the only other option, and then we become just as much enthralled with the myths that the Republicans have with the Norquist Oath and things along those lines. I mean, is there really no distinction to be had anymore? Potentially?
No, I think that's the parties are. Look, one of the classic. I'm not worried about that. Because that's so far from happening.
Well, Obama signed the NDAA is pretty severe, yeah. you know. I mean,
but you're talking about if the Democrats actually became a cause you could believe in, and would that compromise us? And you know, cross that bridge and we come to it. It's never going
to
happen.
So it's going to have to be third party, which you just said previously was impossible.
Well, it's off the table. Also, I don't know if there is an answer.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know if there is an answer. This is, look, at the end of the day, we're responsible adults, and you have to look the situation that we're in the face.
Yeah.
And you know, this has been going on for 40 years. The world has been on a gallop to the right for 40 years. And what is the power that's capable of halting that or arresting that or reversing that? I don't know what it is. I used to think it was organized labor, but
yeah.
they've done nothing but lose in
yeah.
my lifetime. I
yeah.
mean, nothing but lose.
Stephen Greenhouse has a great book, The Big Squeeze, on the
yeah,
loss of unions. It's depressing,
fantastic
but it's fascinating. You
yeah.
Know? Yeah,
but we
yeah.
have to, the first step in any of these things is you have to look this in the face beyond ideology and look at what's actually happened. You know, so that's where I start from.
Yeah.
Also, look, at the end of the day, I am a journalist, and I'm not interested in parties. I'm interested in describing the world that we live in and getting it right. The world is so fascinating. You know, one of the things, the Tea Party movement fascinates me because it's so perverse. Not because I want to go out and fight the right wing anymore. You know, I studied cultural history. That was my field. This thing, the Tea Party movement, the swerve to the right since 2008, this is amazing in strict cultural terms, okay, that this is going on in our enlightened age, okay?
Yeah,
it blows me away every
yeah.
time I think about it. And, you know, putting all the politics and ideology and disasters of it aside, I'm fascinated by it.
You like a train wreck.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that explains why you ran Atlas Shrugged at the end.
At one point in this book, I actually called up the leading historian of train wrecks. Did you get to that point?
Yeah, I did. On the note of train wrecks, it seems a great way to end this conversation. Tom, thanks so much. It was a pleasure chatting with you.
Oh, it was a great conversation.
Fantastic.